Welcome to New Human Living Radio Show, bringing you powerful interviews to awaken the power in you. Learn more at newhumanliving.com. And now your host, Les Jensen.
So the evolution of consciousness, dun, 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 the journey we're all on, like it or not. What I really like about tonight's show is we're going to talk about the evolution of consciousness, but as a collective, not a collective like every flipping person on the planet, but very much a very powerful movement that touched the heart of so many people from the mid-60s to the mid-70s and beyond, even today, really. But the topic tonight is the inner light and the Beatles. And our guest tonight is Joanne DiMaggio. We're going to bring her on in just a minute. But inner light, boy, howdy. I just love that topic. You know, if you think about the ego, our egos, if you have an ego, raise your hand. Yeah, come on, you in the back, come on. The consciousness, that fuels our ego is not generated by the ego. It's not. Within us, our inner light, if you will, that portal, that really eternal portal of consciousness that illuminates our persona, including our ego. Our ego runs on the consciousness of our inner light. And so when we talk about the inner light, I love this topic. I absolutely love this topic. We're talking about the most innate, natural part of who we are. So before you were born, there's the inner light illuminating your soul. There's the inner light illuminating your soul as your soul plans its incarnation. Your ego, which didn't exist the day you were born, is kind of like, remember shuffling your feet across the carpet on a dry day and you're building a static charge? You didn't have a static charge when you started shuffling your feet, but you took on a static charge as you go across the carpet. And then metaphorically, when we air quote die, air quote, is when we touch the light switch and we discharge that static charge. The static charge is not the truth of us, no more than your ego is the truth of you. If you were to magically invite three or four different versions of you from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever's appropriate for you to sit down at a table, you evolve, you change, your ego changes, your perception of life changes. But the constant is the whole flipping rodeo. Every moment of every lifetime you've ever had has been illuminated in each now by that inner light. And tonight we're going to look at a revolution, so to speak, where the Beatles, I don't think they need any introduction, the Beatles took us as fans, took us on a journey, and the world watched the Beatles from when they first got together as young kids with no prominent sense of spirituality, and on a public stage, quite literally and also metaphorically, they lived a very accelerated spiritual evolution, and the world watched it. The world watched it. So if you've been listening to this radio show for however long, we're in our 14th year, chances are you are on your own spiritual evolution, your own spiritual journey. And so when we talk about the Beatles tonight and we talk about their evolution, their spiritual evolution, it relates directly to every one of us. And I think we're going to have a wonderful conversation tonight, so I think we should get to it. Again, the topic tonight, it's the title of our guest's latest book, The Inner Light. The subtitle, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. And our guest tonight is Joanne DiMaggio. The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seeds in Our Soul. For over 35 years, Joanne has pursued a passionate interest in reincarnation research and past life therapy. Having penned many books on the topic, she was highly sought after, conference speaker, and acclaimed guest on numerous radio programs and podcasts, including this one. We're delighted to have her back. Joanne explores the band members' esoteric beliefs, particularly expanded and reflected in their music after their trip to India to work with transcendental meditation. Joanne has also pieced together group members' viewpoints on reincarnation, death, past lives, group incarnations, astrology, tarot, numerology, and kundalini energy. She also explores how John Lennon and Paul McCartney used writing in an altered state of consciousness to compose some of their music. At the end of the book, Joanne revisits the question of whether the Beatles were the ones responsible for illuminating the path that led her from being a Beatles fan club president to a career as an acclaimed past life researcher and author. She answers it with a resounding yes. You can learn more about Joanne at joannedimaggio.com. That is JOANNEDIMAGGIO.com. I think we should get to it. Join me in welcoming Joanne to the show, back on the show. Welcome to the show, Joanne.
Thanks, Les. It's great to be with you again.
Did you even have a sense of how these four members of the band called the Beatles, I mean, in your early days when you were first introduced to the Beatles, did you have any sense that this was going to be such a profound influence on not only yourself, but really the world?
Absolutely no clue. No clue whatsoever. I just was a teenager who just fell in love with these four gorgeous men from England and just loved that music. And they truly filled a void. I know in my life and in the lives of countless others at a time in history when we really needed it. So I think it was all divinely orchestrated. And but back then there was no way, and there was no reason to even make the connection between the music and the group back in 1964 to how it would evolve by the time that they broke up and the fan clubs dissolved in 1972.
Well, it was a very tumultuous time. I mean, we had here in the States, we had riots, we had protests, we had there was a movement of kinds. Like I remember Timothy Leary saying, "Drop out, tune in, turn on."
yeah.
Ram Dass was prominent back in those days. Robert Anton Wilson and others. There was, but if you go back, not much, not really very far chronologically, a decade or two. I mean, we're in the like 50s, and everything's a kind of a white picket fence quote reality unquote.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much upheaval mm-hmm. in our culture collectively, and then along comes this band, and I love your subtitle, "How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Soul."
Mm-hmm.
When tell us about your story as far as when you first engaged the Beatles and how you became a president of the fan club.
Well, I was 14 when they first came to the United States. And one of the things I wanted to mention when you were talking about the time we were living in, the Beatles came in February of 64. And if you just back up a few months to November of 63, that's when we lost President Kennedy was assassinated. And so that put, I think, a mood across the whole country. And I think across my generation, I think we were especially hard hit because we really believed in what, in a change that was coming in, the whole Kennedy mystique. And so we're all in mourning about this tremendous loss. It's a dark time. And then suddenly here's, "She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah." And I saw her standing there and all that. And it was like, okay, all right. I could put a smile back on my face. I could start dancing. So I think that they did a lot. I think we were primed for them to have as much of an impact on us that maybe they wouldn't have if politically things were different. But then, during those years, we had a lot of other major political and civil things, culturally things were changing very rapidly. As far as my involvement, I always was the kind of person that liked to network. I loved to get like-minded people together. I still do. And I thought, I'm a fairly good writer. I could do a newsletter. How about if we get a Beatle fan club? I'll get a Beatle fan club together. And at first I thought it was just going to be some of my school friends and we were going to just meet at my house. And I remember I took over the basement. I lived with my family on the south side of Chicago at that time in a little bungalow. So we had a walkout basement. It was all knotty pine. And I plastered the walls with all my posters of the Beatles. And my mom had one big clunky Underwood typewriter, manual typewriter. And she taught me how to type. And so off I go doing these newsletters and having my friends come over. And then eventually it just started to grow. And I started to reach out. Some of the magazines that were published back then that were devoted to the Beatles had a section that had pen pals. And so I would, that was my early venturing into marketing. So I would start writing to people, hey, you want to join my fan club? And so the club had many different, it evolved. I kept changing the name, like I couldn't make up my mind what I wanted to call it. And so for many years, it just grew and grew and grew. And then eventually, the National Club in New York, which was under the auspices of Apple Records, they were the official Beatles fan club. And there might have been maybe 100 of us little independent clubs all through the country at the time. And they sent out letters kind of like a cease and desist letter, you know, like they wanted all of us under their umbrella. And so I was like, this was like my David and Goliath story. You know, I wasn't going to give up my independence to this big conglomerate. And so I engaged the assistance of a wonderful DJ in Chicago at WCFL called Jim Stagg. And Jim had a weekly column in the Chicago Sun-Times called The Stagg Line. And he printed my letter, and he sort of became our advocate. And for a while, things got quiet. But then after a while, here comes the club again and putting some pressure on all of us until there were only three of us left. And I finally gave in, and they sweetened the pot for me and said, you know, how about if you become national chapter director and you become the liaison between the official club in New York and all the fan clubs across the country, to which I agreed. And so then we became a chapter of the official Beatles fan club in New York. And eventually I became president of the Paul McCartney fan club.
Wow. Well, it's funny because I sit here and I think about the Beatles in their later years when they were into psychedelics and mm-hmm. all manner of mischief or had they come out as in that persona in the beginning, the conservative churches and whatnot would drag them out in the field and club them to death because they because it was such a distinctive thing. But here are four kids, I mean, young kids, they get together and they start playing I Want to Hold Your Hand. And that's the most innocent thing you can think of. But even still then, they weren't received well by the conservative aspect of our culture. They were tagged right off the top, weren't they? That they were, I don't know the words, degenerates, you know, and stay mm-hmm. away from them, bad news. How did, because you grew up as a Catholic girl. How did your Catholic environment perceive the Beatles in those early days?
I don't recall that was ever brought up or that it was ever an issue. I know that there was a lot of criticism of them because of the way they looked. You know, obviously
right.
nobody looked like that before. the first that we really got backlash was when John made the comment that they were more popular than Jesus. That was, from what I can remember, the first statement that one of them made that caused that kind of a response in that. You know, remember their records were being burned,
right?
And they were banned. Music was banned, especially in the South, Bible Belt. And I live
right.
in the South now, so I can say that. You know, I knew what John meant by that remark, and I knew that it wasn't at all what people were perceiving it to be, that it was totally taken out of context. But it was the first of several times that something they said or did resulted in our losing a considerable number of members, because there were fans who said, you know, I just can't go there. I just can't support them anymore. So I remember writing an article in our newsletter defending John, and, you know, saying what he really meant by what he said. When he was actually true what he was saying, and but he didn't mean it the way people took it. So that was the first time I didn't feel any sense of animosity or resistance coming from my Catholic upbringing, not toward the Beatles, but I sure as heck felt it when it came time that I started to put some interest into reincarnation. That's when I got a lot of pushback. But as far as the Beatles were concerned, that wasn't the case. The other times when we lost a lot of members, by the way, was when Paul admitted he had taken LSD. Lost a lot of people because of that. And then when they went to India, a lot of fans just could not. They weren't resonating to what they were doing. They thought they were really going off the deep end, and so we lost a lot of members then. So it came in waves, you know. But there were some like me who stuck with it from beginning to end, felt that they were an important and essential part of our lives. It wasn't like they were so far away and that we looked at them from afar and admired them that way. We lived and breathed them. Everything they said, we were like little sponges, you know. We just absorbed everything that they said, and that became our truth. We were kind of walking around like repeating what they were saying, and then not realizing, especially in the later years, when they were getting into their more, when especially George, and to some extent John, you know, were starting to venture into a much more profound, more esoteric beliefs, and incorporating that into their music. So it was an evolution all the way around.
Well, and I find that interesting. That's what I really like about this topic, is because on a world stage, they're so quickly in just years, they're, like I've been saying, they went from naive kids to these quite evolved spiritual guys. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the way you share how people could only go so far with them, and, you know, it's like, oh, wait, stop. Now they're talking about LSD. I can't do mm-hmm. that. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And for yourself, growing up Catholic and then getting around to reincarnation, when we bump up against something that is culturally and perhaps individually out of our wheelhouse, so to speak, a lot right. of times we can just stop there in our quote spiritual growth stops, because we can't assimilate some aspect of a deeper truth. I mean, a lot of religions still shun the idea of reincarnation, and yet we've had so many episodes on the show about NDEs mm-hmm. and whatnot. I like how the Beatles on a public stage incrementally climb the whole flipping metaphorical ladder, so to speak. And from your perspective, you had kind of an insider's point of view as far as how the public was taking it.
I had a lot. One of the things I did in this book is I devoted an entire chapter to I had interviewed about 10 Beatle fans who were my age, and I asked them the question, you know, did the Beatles affect your spirituality? Did it at all? Did they at all, encourage you to go into a certain line of work? Like in my case, you know, become a past life therapist. And it was interesting to me because they were from all different religions. They were not all Catholic. But the one thing one person said that I found really pretty much says it all, she said they taught us that we did not have to stay inside the box, that we
right.
could that we could explore, we could go out of the box. And I think that that's what, if I'm going to be critical at all of my Catholic upbringing, they wanted me to stay in the box.
Sure.
And I went to 12 years of Catholic schooling, and I asked a lot of questions because some things made absolutely no sense to me. And so the whole concept of sin, you know, the way they were explaining it, the idea of going, you know, you only get this one chance, and if you mess up, you go directly to hell, and that's the end of it. And
right.
so I never conceived that I could think that there was any other way. And I think the Beatles gave all of us permission. Heck yes, it's okay. Go ahead, look, explore, see what else is out there, what feels right to you, and then go with it. So, boy, I owe them a debt because of that.
Well, it's their music was just, and still is, so powerful to, like you say, think outside the box. And they had pushback not only from religion and religious institutions, but also from the perhaps academic or authoritarian institutions that wanted everybody in a box. I mean, they were, my sense is they didn't see themselves doing this perhaps off the top, but maybe later on in the years they turn and look in hindsight at just how pivotal they have been in our culture. Now, you ran the club for 8 years. Can you think of some of the pivotal moments of those years?
Well, as I said, I think the comment that John made about Jesus and the LSD and certainly when when George did the Bangladesh concert, that was big, and that was really the beginning of the end of the fan clubs, and was because, you know, there were no more Beatles. I think that we dealt with a lot of rumors all the time that they were breaking up, and we had to sort of hang on. Back then, we didn't have the internet, so and I didn't have a word processor to do my newsletters on.
Right.
And so any news that we got it the way everybody else got it, which was in a newspaper or a magazine article or on the radio. We relied on our DJs to give us information or whatever the fan club was sending out. So it was always sort of, you know, after the fact. So when all this started happening where Paul's saying that he wanted to leave the group, or that's what they were reporting, by the time we got that news, it was like, you know, quite late, much later than that. So for me, when I was running the club, I was trying to have meetings. I would get a downtown Chicago hotel meeting room and invite, you know, members of the club to come. They weren't always highlights because sometimes those meetings did not end well. I got written up not only in the Sun Times by Jim Stagg, but also in the Chicago Tribune. A reporter showed up at one of our meetings. And at that point, we were the biggest issue we were having was the younger fans just coming up, and the older fans that had been with the Beatles since the beginning. There was definitely some conflict between the two groups. And so that's what this reporter wrote about. And some of the things that I wrote in the newsletters, we got all caught up in their personal lives. You know, there were factions out there that didn't like Paul's wife, didn't like Yoko, and let everybody know about it. And so it just seemed to me, and I didn't see it at the time, but later on I did, that there were parallels going on between what was going on with the group, with the Beatles as a group, and what was going on with the fans. So if there was tension in the group, there was tension in the fans. If there was, if they were being separated or divided, so were we. So it was, and I was young then. I had no clue how to deal with any of this. I had no conflict resolution experience. And I wasn't very diplomatic. Some of the things that I wrote in my newsletters, when I did the research for the book, I went back. I had saved all my newsletters from 1964 to 1972. So I went back and I'm rereading some of the things because I was looking for clues in the newsletters about this whole idea of planting the spiritual seed. To see if any fan had written and I had printed their letter. Did they say anything along those lines? And some of the stuff that I wrote, honestly, Les, it was cringeworthy. I mean, I could not believe that how judgmental we all were. And I think it's because we were so young. You know, it wasn't like, to me, this was a whole coming of age type of book. And I thought, oh, I have nothing here that I'm really that proud of. But it was just interesting that we were pitted against each other instead of working together, keeping it all together. The Beatles weren't keeping it together, so neither were we. And it just got reflected in the what was going on in the fan clubs until eventually George Harrison, which is ironic that it would be George of all people, put an end to the fan clubs, and they issued a statement that there would be no more fan clubs because there were no more Beatles. So that was the end of that. So,
wow.
I was all those years. Sometimes I would get so frustrated and so depressed that I would say, I'm giving this up. Why am I doing this? Because I was spending all of my money, and I must have spent at least $10,000 on the fan club, and this is back in the 60s. Plus, I was going to high school, and then I was going to college. So, and my parents started to say, you're too old for this. You should stop doing that. And a couple of times I tried to quit, but it reminded me of that scene from The Godfather. When Michael Corleone says, just when I thought I was getting out, they pull me back in.
Right.
And so that's how I felt, because I didn't want to give it up because it was my baby. I had nurtured this thing for 8 years, but eventually we all had to let go. I think some of the independent fan clubs went back to their independent status and kept going, but certainly I let my club go.
That's interesting. When you mentioned that as the band went, so went the fans. Like when the band was in turmoil, the fans would reflect that. And I worked in broadcast TV for like forever, and you started seeing that kind of correlation between what you put on the air and what the public does. Like maybe a public figure, a mayor or somebody, gets a DUI, and then for the next month, DUIs skyrocket or go up or whatever. And it seems like whatever we put our consciousness on has perhaps a deeper effect on us. For me, it seems like the Bangladesh and when the band went to India, that was a pretty big pivot point. I would say for John Lennon and George Harris, probably the most. How do you remember the influence of that time of the band?
Well, to be honest with you, I did not resonate at all to the music that George was producing at the time. He was learning the sitar from Ravi Shankar, and he was incorporating that sound in his music. And to me, it was fingernails on a chalkboard. And so what happened was I wouldn't listen to the words because I didn't like the sound of the music. And I think, judging from the letters that I was getting from those in the fan club, a lot of other fans felt the same way. So we had a difficult time making that transition. However, the fact that they were learning the transcendental meditation was intriguing to me. And the music that was coming out of that time there was wonderful. And when I started actually listening to the words to George's music, it was opening up a whole new world for me. It was, I always leaned in the direction of the more profound to begin with. And so this was touching my soul. This was saying something that I had felt but could not articulate. Certainly couldn't do that through my Catholic upbringing. So this meant a great deal to me. But like I said, most of us didn't understand what the heck they were doing over there. And yet, you know, today meditation is such an important part of my work. And the writing in a state of altered state of consciousness and a method that I call soul writing, which is really just a written form of meditation, I had no idea that that's how some of their music, John and Paul, that's how some of their music was coming to them. Not all of it. I'm not saying that they used it all the time, and I'm not saying that they used the exact process. But you know, when they were talking about for Paul yesterday and Let It Be, and for John, I think it was Nowhere Man and Across the Universe. You know, that some of this came to them either in a dreamlike state. So when they were describing, you know, how the music came to them, it sounded an awful lot like soul writing. So there were a lot of seeds being planted back then that I didn't have a name for, and I didn't know what it was, but it was there nonetheless, and it must have subconsciously gotten planted within me, and then it didn't surface until about 15 years later after they broke up, for me, 1987, when Shirley MacLaine, her book Out on a Limb became a miniseries, and in it she's talking about reincarnation, and that was my big wake-up call. So it was interesting for me, the evolution. I was reading books about reincarnation before the Beatles came into my life. So I was about 11, 12 years old when I was reading those books, because I was so disenchanted with Catholicism and I was looking for something else, and I started reading books about reincarnation. And then the Beatles came in 64, and I just put it all on the back burner, stayed with the Beatles for 8 years, then the Beatles broke up, and then there was 15 years where I'm in La La Land. I don't even know what I was doing then. And then suddenly in 1987, here comes Shirley MacLaine, and I haven't looked back since then. I've been pursuing my passion for reincarnation research and therapy. And so I really do feel that passion stemmed from my knowing the Beatles and
being so intimately involved with the fan club, and then, you know, hanging on their every word and reading all of the things that they said subsequently about reincarnation and numerology and past lives and soul contracts and all of that. So, you know, we've paralleled each other all the way over the last 60 years. It's very interesting to me.
Well, it's, you know, you don't, in general, people don't transform in an instant. You don't go from being a Catholic to a Buddhist in a flash. I mean, you might have a spiritual experience that changes you, but we have so much momentum to ourselves. I guess I would call it a momentum, because if you think about, you mentioned in the early days of Catholicism that it wasn't speaking to you, and you looked at reincarnation to evolve your persona from that Catholic idea of you, perhaps even at a younger age when you were, I can't speak for you, but in your family household, Catholicism might have been the only prominent perception. And then you bring on, as you shared in your youth, you were interested in reincarnation, and then fast forward today, you're actually that's you're a researcher and therapist. What I'm getting at is, as we grow, we have to bring the whole of us along, so to speak. I mean, we've got to dismantle the incongruent parts of ourselves. And what I'm getting at is, the Beatles, through music, the power of music, they shook us all out of our box, so to speak. And it like you've shared, it wasn't always a cakewalk. There was upheaval after upheaval after upheaval. And do you, this is a joke, do you even see any upheaval going on in our collective consciousness now?
Oh, gosh. Just let me think. Wait a minute. Oh, Lord. Duh. Yes.
So the music was like, it put an edge on the change of humanity, and perhaps it took the edge off of it, because music can be so powerful that way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would get lost in that music, just totally start daydreaming, you know, thinking about the words, letting the music just pull me away. And, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, I grew up in a very blue-collar, south side of Chicago kind of neighborhood. You would not utter the word reincarnation.
Right.
I know if I brought it up at all in school, the nuns and the priests would lecture me about how, you know, the Catholic faith is the one true faith and you shouldn't question it. And I get those kind of lectures. And so instead of them really taking the time to talk to me, they just shut me down all the time. So then I was sort of left to my own devices, you know, what am I going to do? And I started doing my own little research. So the seed was planted. The seed of discontent was planted before the Beatles even got into my life. And then they sort of took me away and then very gently led me into these different stages. You know, I mean, I was absolutely shocked when I did the research for the book. I went through about 60 different Beatle biographies, and I came up with 16 pages, single-spaced, of quotes that I found from mostly George, some from John, a few from Paul, none at all from Ringo, about their you know, some aspect of metaphysical beliefs. So I learned a lot about John that I didn't know. But George primarily was, and it was, you know, it was interesting because I was studying the Edgar Cayce readings, and I consider Edgar Cayce my greatest metaphysical teacher. And it was everything that I had studied on my path to becoming a past life researcher and therapist, when I would read something that George would say, was right in alignment exactly with what I learned and what I believed in. And that surprised me, because within the metaphysical community, there are people who have various different takes on topics, you know, that we would get into. But George was always right there, right in parallel with what Cayce said and what I had learned and come to believe. So it was like a affirmation in a way for me to revisit the things that he had said. Now, I truly believe that the four of them had a soul contract. You know, I talk a lot about soul groups in my work, and, you know, they had a divine mission that they came together. And so there's just a lot of aspects of what I work with people, you know, exploring their past lives, exploring their pre-life planning session. You know, how did they, you know, how did they decide what they wanted to work on karmically in this life? And so the agreements that we make on a soul level with each other to come in and assist each one another so that we can get past some of these karmic issues that we've brought in with us, but pull on our karmic attributes, the things that we already have mastered. So everything that I was doing, everything that I was teaching, everything that I was learning from my clients, they had already set the map out for me, so to speak. So I'm following along on this little path, you know, in parallel with what they, and here I'd never met them. I'd never really spoken to them. It shows how beautiful the whole universe is, the way things work, the way they do. So I was just felt so privileged to have been a part of all of this and to say, yes, absolutely, they planted the seed within me and within, you know, thousands of other Beatlemaniacs across the world.
Right. Well, you've kind of metaphorically got in the heads of the band members with how closely you were involved with them. This is just a curious question for me, because from my perspective, John Lennon and George Harrison seem to be the, I don't know what the hell to call it, front runner or the, as far as the spiritual insights that they've came across. Do you see a big difference between the two, or are they pretty much in step with each other?
I do see a difference between them. John was much more political than George was, I think. It seemed to me like George was like, you know, looking for this deeper meaning and how do you apply it to your life and wanting to teach others. He wanted to share this with everybody. That was his goal, you know. Just let me just share this with you. I found this out and I want to share it with you. I think John sometimes, you know, I think he went a little bit, I don't want to use the word overboard because I don't know what the word would be though if I didn't say that word.
Right.
Because he got mixed up in things. Yeah, he got mixed up in things that I thought were ridiculous. I thought were truly meaningless and had no long-term benefit. So I think that, but the things that he was saying, if he would just isolate that, they were they were truly, truly wonderful and insightful. You know, he and Yoko were very much into reincarnation. He believed that they were the reincarnation of Robert Browning and Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And I know that they had artifacts from ancient Egypt. I know they were really into numerology. I know they had, I mentioned they had an astrologer that they consulted, a numerologist, a psychic. So all of that kind of was going on. But I mean, as far as making like these vast, these statements that people could actually understand and apply, I think that's where George came in. So I think he was really the spiritual leader of the group, George was. And I think John was in there, but I think John came from a whole different perspective. And I think Paul, I think maybe there's more to Paul than we know in terms of what he believes. I've heard that he still uses meditation. He still does the transcendental meditation. So he may be a closet metaphysician. I don't really know. And I don't know about Ringo because he never really shared anything.
Right.
I think one time he made a comment about he wanted to come back as an animal or a cat or something. You know, that doesn't work that way. So that was the only reference to reincarnation that I could find for him. I love him so much. It's fine. It's okay. He doesn't have to go along the same path as everybody else.
Right. Well, we had you on the show for your book, Edgar Cayce and the Unfulfilled Destiny of Thomas Jefferson Reborn. We were, you and I were talking the other day about the soul's idea of an incarnation. You know, the soul says, okay, my plan is I'm going to incarnate, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And then the flippin' ego shows up, and then it all turns into a wild card. I'm kind of shifting gears a little bit here, but you have such a rapport with reincarnation, soul intention, and whatnot. How do you see the ego? I mean, you could. Perhaps how it relates to the Beatles or just in general, if the ego was 100% aware of the intent of the soul, and that's extremely rare, but just share your reflection as far as how the ego can kind of perhaps get in the way or maybe a bad way to say it is dumb down the vision because it can't see itself growing into what the soul might intend?
Well, each of us has been endowed with this gift from the divine called free will. And when I wrote that book about Edgar Cayce and the reincarnation of Thomas Jefferson, you know, Cayce had said about that soul that he could do for the world what Jefferson did for this country. Of course, he didn't do that. And so because of that, he got a really bad rap. And people would look at him and go, oh, Cayce said you could do this for the world and you haven't done anything, you know. Well, what happened, you know, why? And, I mean, he was given that prediction when he was 2 days old. The reason I did the book was to really explore what happened. Why didn't it work out the way Cayce saw it? Or I think Cayce gave a probability. So, you know, there were decisions that were made that put him on a whole different trajectory. And the decisions were not made based on that advice. They were made based on other reasons. And they were made sometimes on very selfish reasons. So at any given point in time, we can go on a whole different path. We might be going along, la-da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, look, isn't this wonderful? You know, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And all of a sudden, I'm not going to do that anymore. I don't want to do that anymore. Or if whatever reason you come up with. I think that the Beatles had a soul contract to come together. They obviously knew each other in prior lifetimes. They each brought into that group dynamic talent, skill, and ability that propelled them forward as a group. Now, what happened? The ego did get in the way there. The ego said, you know, I'm going to go off and do my own thing. And for whatever reason, I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that's what it was. So they all decided, okay, well, I mean, it's not like they sat down and go, what should we do on a soul level? I mean, what do you think our souls want us to do, right?
Right.
You know, I'm sure they didn't have that conversation. I'm sure that wasn't even a thought. You know, they were all into their own egos, into what they individually wanted to do, and it was no longer the group dynamic. So that changed. And in changing it, we lost a tremendous amount of music. Who knows if they had stayed together longer, how they would have evolved. If they evolved that quickly in 8 years, what would they have been like in 10 years or 15 years?
Right.
You know? So it's at any given point in time, we can change our minds. So when I do the pre-life planning session with people, I wrote a whole book, and I named it, the title of it is I Did It to Myself Again, because I had found a lot of my clients were blaming everybody in their lives for the way their life was going. Oh, it's all
right.
My husband's fault. Oh, it's my mother's fault. And yet it wasn't, because you set it up. You set it up this way. Your soul said, I have certain things I want to learn, certain experiences I want to have, and in order to have that, X, Y, and Z needs to take place. So I really do think that we have some guidelines coming into this life. It's not like we're coming in blind. At any point in time, we could tap into that and figure out what it is that we really, truly wanted to do. That is the first question my clients ask me. When I ask them, why do you want to do a regression, they'll say, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't know why I'm here. So so that's the soul yearning to have purpose, to have a reason for existing. But I do think that the ego, in the form of free will, could just get in there, either guide us and keep us on track, or go on the detour. So it just depends on each individual.
Well, I mean, you have so much experience as a past life regressioner. The I want, well, like for myself, I get this impulse, write a book. You know, come on, let's write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And my ego argued with my heart and my soul for 6 years. Write a book? Hell no. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And now that I've written books, well, damn. I kind of like writing. Writing's a cool thing.
Uh-huh.
And had my ego not been such a stubborn, bullheaded some bitch, I could have enjoyed writing much earlier in my life. So my question for you is, I know we have free will, and I know the ego can tip the card over or get in step and get it going. What would you tell the ego of the listener? I know we have free will, but in general, the way egos can resist an intention of a soul, what would you tell the egos of the listeners as far as how it might not seem obvious to them? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you know what I mean? Because
yeah.
So often it's the ego that gets in the way. What would you say to that?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on that topic because, I mean, we have to, ego keeps us alive. Ego keeps us safe. So it has a place in our lives, but it is not part of our spiritual life. It's we're spiritual beings inhabiting a physical body, so that ego is attached to that physical body. The spirituality part of us is part of that spiritual body, and that's the one that has to take precedence. That's the one that should have the louder voice. So I think people need to really do some meditative work and really separate the two out, and to recognize when it is an ego-based comment coming into your psyche. One of the things when I teach soul writing, for instance, one of the things I tell people is there's a difference between soul writing and automatic writing. And what is it? One is written in the third person, and one is written in the first person. The automatic writing is first person. I tell you this. I am who you should listen to. I demand that you do this and that and this and that. So it's all I-based is ego-based. So, however, when you're doing the soul writing, it's we, the collective consciousness, we. We are with you always in love and in light. And that is the voice to listen to. That's the voice that will guide us. The ego, will get us into trouble every time. So learning to separate them out, learning to know which voice you're hearing is half the battle right there. I mean, there were times when my ego took me off the path far longer than I had wanted to. And then when I looked back on it, I could see that that's what it was. You know, the ego was telling me that I wanted something, and I did want it, and it made it bigger and bigger and bigger. This was something I really, like I had an opportunity to help launch a metaphysical magazine, and I was so excited about it, and it didn't work out. Well, it wasn't intended to work out from the start, but I didn't see that. So I think that learning to be discerning and knowing the difference between the two voices, the spiritual, the soul talking to you, and the ego talking to you. Like I said, I'm not an expert in this area. It doesn't really come up that much in my work, believe it or not. But, you know, you could tell from, like I'll say to people, what's the last thought you had when your soul left your body, when they're going through the regression, you know? And usually that's, they'll make an ego-based statement then. And then you sort of know from based on that statement what it is that they're going to be working on in this life, you know? So,
nice.
It's very interesting to me. It's fascinating. As a matter of fact, how that all works out. But I really think that there is a decided difference between the two voices. You just have to discern which one it is.
Right. Well, time can fly by pretty fast. I want you to take even more time, and let's put the attention on you, your books, your practice. Share with the audience your webpage, your books. For your practice, do you do it online? Is it in person? Tell us all about you and your resources.
Okay, well, I've been doing this work since 1987. I do everything online. Since when COVID hit, I closed my office. And a colleague of mine said, oh, you can do regressions on Zoom. And I said, how is that possible? And actually, they're better on Zoom than in person because people are very comfortable. They're in their own home environment. So for those of your listeners who are interested, I do offer several different types of past life regressions. I've got one that's a simple regression, one that includes the soul writing that I had mentioned earlier. I also do one for physical karma, so anybody that has a chronic condition in this life, we could trace it back to a past life and do some healing that way. And then I do the pre-life planning session as well. So you could read about those on my website, joannedimaggio.com. You could also book a session right on my online calendar. All my books are listed there. I've got several on soul writing. I do have that one on the pre-life planning. I've got the one on the soul, on on the chronic conditions called Karma Can Be a Real Pain. I've got that book on Thomas Jefferson, Reborn, and Edgar Cayce. And then the new one, of course, The Inner Light. So I have a blog on there. I have case studies on there. I've got some soul writing messages on there. So there's quite a bit. I would encourage people to explore it. I do a monthly newsletter. You can sign up for the newsletter right on the website. I'm also going to be teaching a summer soul writing series through the ARE. That's Edgar Cayce's ARE. July 16th, every Tuesday from 10 till 11:30. It's a Zoom class until the end of August. So if you want to do a deep dive into learning soul writing, you know, you're welcome to join us. I also teach soul writing individually, and that's also on my website if people are interested. So I'd love to hear from people. If they want to email me, it's joanne@joannedimaggio.com. But I don't do phone consultations, so just so everybody understands it. And my next project, I just started working on it. I'm really excited about it. It's going to be on soulmates. So I'm looking to start to do some, get some volunteers who've had a soulmate experience, and we're going to include those as case studies in the book.
Very nice. Well, Joanne, it's been a delight having you back on the show. I've thoroughly enjoyed this episode. I want to thank you for being our guest tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Les. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Joanne DiMaggio, and the topic tonight is the title of her latest book, The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Soul. What a fun conversation. I've been fascinated lately by the idea of the ego and the idea of the soul and how we show up or how we don't show up for ourselves. I think a lot of times when our egos get overwhelmed with a lot of new information, a lot of conflicting information, perhaps a form of chaos, if you will. If you look at social media and the collective and mainstream media and whatnot, there's a real collage of very contradictory information. And a lot of times the ego can tend to like hunker down and dig in, so to speak, to try to traverse the chaos, if you will. But the reason I bring this up is I think a lot of us are at a pivot point in our lives, in that the upheaval that has hit the collective in the last couple of years is this next chapter as humanity transforms itself through the chaos. This next chapter is, I think, for a lot of us, is going to be kind of a new narrative, a new paradigm of, quote, why we're here, unquote. In other words, our soul saw this chaos coming, and a lot of our soul's intentions for our life might just be coming online now. In other words, we were born for this chapter, this new chapter. And your life purpose, you the listener, your life purpose, you might have had some ideas rattling around in your head for a while, maybe your whole flipping lifetime, or maybe just recently, that is a tangent or a new direction for your life. And just be mindful. I don't want to ever tell you what to do, but just be mindful of, I like how Joanne said it, who's doing the thinking? Is it the soul or is it the ego? So just be mindful that perhaps you have a new chapter coming online now. So what a fun episode. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's an exciting time to be alive. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a New Human Living broadcast. I'm your host, Les Jensen. Let me ask you a question. How many times during today, this day, has your heart and soul had direct communication with you? Our egos, left unchecked, will easily consume all of our thoughts and consciousness as we go throughout the day, where we really are living an ego-led life. But our ego cannot even comprehend the vision our soul has for us. If you want to increase your personal power, make space throughout your day for your heart and soul to inspire you. Citizen King, The New Age of Power, is a book I wrote just for that. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for listening.